sugar. And what was true of drinks might also be true of people and ideas and emotions. The idea was interesting. When people make decisions, they are also making judgments about similarity between some object in the real world and what they ideally want. They make these judgments by, in effect, counting up the features they notice. And as the noticeability of features can be manipulated by the way they are highlighted, the sense of how similar two things are might also be manipulated. For instance, if you wanted two people to think of themselves as more similar to each other than they otherwise might, you might put them in a context that stressed the features they shared. Two American college students in the United States might look at each other and see a total stranger. The same two college students on their junior year abroad in Togo might find that they are surprisingly similar. They're both Americans. By changing the context in which two things are compared, you submerge certain features and force others to the surface. It is generally assumed that classifications are determined by similarities among the objects, wrote Amos, before offering up an opposing view that the similarity of objects is modified by the manner in which they are classified. Thus, similarity has two faces, causal and derivative. It serves as a basis for the classification of objects, but is also influenced by the adopted classification. A banana and an apple seem more similar than they otherwise would, because we've agreed to call them both fruit. Things are grouped together for a reason, but once they are grouped, their grouping causes them to seem more like each other than they otherwise would. That is, the mere act of classification reinforces stereotypes. If you want to weaken some stereotype, eliminate the classification. Amos's theory didn't exactly contribute to the existing conversation about how people made judgments of similarity. It took over the entire conversation. Everyone else at the party just circled around Amos and listened. Amos's approach to doing science wasn't incremental, said Rich Gonzalez. It proceeded by leaps and bounds. You find a paradigm that is out there, you find a general proposition of that paradigm, and you destroy it. He saw himself doing a negative style of science. He used the word a lot, negative. This turns out to be a very powerful way of doing social science. That's how Amos would begin, by undoing the mistakes of others. As it turned out, other people had made some other mistakes. Chapter 4. Errors. By the time Amos returned to Israel in the fall of 1966, he had been gone for 5 years. His oldest friends naturally compared the returning Amos to the Amos of their memories. They noticed a couple of changes. The Amos who returned from America appeared to them more serious about his work and to have acquired a whiff of professionalism. He was now an assistant professor with his own office at Hebrew University. He kept it famously spare. There was never anything on his desk but a mechanical pencil, and if Amos was seated at it, an eraser and the crisply ordered file of whatever project he happened to be working on. When he'd left for the United States, he hadn't owned a suit. When he showed up at Hebrew University in a light blue suit, people were genuinely shocked, and not just by the color. This was inconceivable, says Avishai Margalit. This was something you didn't do. A tie was the symbol of the bourgeoisie. I remember the first time I saw my father in a suit and a tie. It was like finding your father with a whore. Otherwise, Amos was unchanged. The last to go to bed at night, the life of every party, the light to which all butterflies flew, and the freest, happiest, and most interesting person anyone knew. He still did only what he wanted to do. Even his new interest in wearing a suit was more peculiarly Amos than it was bourgeois. Amos chose his suits only by the number and size of the jacket pockets. Along with an interest in pockets, he had what amounted to a fetish for briefcases and acquired dozens of them. He'd returned from 5 years in the most materialistic culture on the face of the earth, with a desire only for objects that might help him impose order on the world around him. Along with a new suit, Amos also had a wife. In Michigan, 3 years earlier, he had met a fellow psychology student named Barbara Gans. They'd started dating after a year. "He told me he didn't want to go back to Israel alone," said Barbara, "and so we got married." She'd grown up in the Midwest and had never been out of the United States. What Europeans often said about Americans, how wildly informal and improvisational they were, was, to her, even more true of Israelis. "All you had were rubber bands and masking tape, so you fix things with rubber bands and masking tape," she said. Though materially poor, Israel felt to her rich in other ways. Israelis, at least the Jewish ones, seemed all to earn roughly the same amount of money and to have their basic needs met. There weren't many luxuries. She and Amos had no phone and no car, but neither did most of the people they knew. The shops were all small and particular. There was the knife sharpener and the stone cutter and the falafel seller. If you needed a carpenter or a painter, you didn't bother to phone them, even if you owned a phone, because they never answered. You went downtown in the afternoon and hoped to bump into them. Everything was personal, all transactions. The standard joke was, someone runs out of their burning house to ask a friend on the street if they know someone in the fire department. There was no television, but there were radios everywhere, and when the BBC came on, everyone stopped whatever they were doing to listen. Those words felt consistently urgent. Everyone was on alert, said Barbara. The tension in the air wasn't at all like the strife in the United States over the Vietnam War. In Israel, the danger felt present and personal. If the Arabs at every border ever stopped fighting among themselves, there was a sense, Barbara said, that they could overrun the country in a matter of hours and kill you. The students at Hebrew University, where Barbara was given a psychology class to teach, seemed to be intent mainly on catching their professors in error. They were shockingly aggressive and lacking in deference. One student had so insulted a visiting American intellectual by interrupting his talk with derisive comments that university officials demanded he seek out the American and apologize. "I'm sorry if I have hurt your feelings," the student had said to the visiting dignitary, "but you see, the talk was so bad." For the final exam in one psychology class, the undergraduates were handed a published piece of research and told to find the flaw in it. On Barbara's second day, 10 minutes into her lecture, a student in the back of the room screamed out, "Not true!" and no one seemed to think anything of it. A distinguished Hebrew University professor delivered a paper titled, "What is Not What in Statistics?" after which a student in the audience announced, loudly enough for many to hear, "This will guarantee him a place in Who is Not Who in Statistics?" And yet, at the same time, Israel took its professors more seriously than America did. Israeli intellectuals were presumed to have some possible relevance to the survival of the Jewish state, and the intellectuals responded by at least pretending to be relevant. In Michigan, Barbara and Amos had lived entirely within the university and spent their time with other academic types. Here they mixed with politicians and generals and journalists and others involved directly in running the country. In his first few months back, Amos gave talks about the latest decision-making theories to the generals in the Israeli Army and the Israeli Air Force, even though the practical application of the theories was, to put it mildly, unclear. "I've never seen a country so concerned with keeping its officials abreast on new developments in academics," Barbara wrote to her family back home in Michigan. And of course, everyone was in the Army, even the professors. And so it was impossible, even for the most rarefied intellectual, to insulate himself from the risks facing the entire society. All were exposed equally to the whims of dictators. That truth was hammered home to Barbara 6 months after she arrived on May 22, 1967, when Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser announced that he was closing the Straits of Tehran to Israeli ships. Most Israeli trade passed through the straits, and the announcement was taken as an act of war. Amos came home one day and said, "The army is going to come for me." He rooted around and found a trunk that held his old paratrooper's uniform. It still fit him. At 10 o'clock that night, the army came for him. It had been 5 years since Amos last jumped from an airplane. He was given an infantry unit to command. The entire country prepared for war, and at the same time tried to judge what kind of war it would be. In Jerusalem, those who remembered the War of Independence feared another siege and emptied the stores of canned goods. People found it hard to assign probabilities to the potential outcomes. A war with Egypt alone would probably be ugly, but survivable. A war with the combined Arab states might mean total annihilation. The Israeli government arranged quietly for the public parks to be consecrated, to allow them to be used as mass graves. The entire country mobilized. Private cars took over the bus routes, as all the buses had been taken by the army. Schoolchildren delivered the milk and the mail. Israeli Arabs, who weren't allowed to serve in the army, volunteered for the jobs left by Jewish conscripts. All the while, an apocalyptic wind blew in from the desert. The sensation was like nothing Barbara had ever experienced. No matter how much you drank, you felt thirsty. No matter how wet the laundry, it was dry inside of 30 minutes. It was 95 degrees, but standing in the desert gale, you hardly noticed it was hot. She went to a kibbutz on the border just outside Jerusalem to help dig trenches. The man in his 40s in charge of the volunteers had lost his leg in the War of Independence and wore a prosthetic. He was a poet. He hobbled about and worked on a poem. Before the fighting began, Amos came home twice. Barbara was struck by how casually her new husband tossed his Uzi on the bed before taking a shower. No big deal. The country was in a state of panic, but Amos seemed unconcerned. He told me there's no reason to worry. It will depend upon air power, and we have it. Our air force will destroy their planes. On the morning of June 5th, with Egypt's army massed along the Israeli border, the Israeli Air Force launched a surprise attack. In a few hours, Israeli pilots destroyed 400 or so planes, virtually the entire Egyptian Air Force. Then the Israeli army rolled into the Sinai. By June 7th, Israel was at war on three fronts against the armies of Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. Barbara went to a bomb shelter in Jerusalem and passed the time sewing sandbags. It was later reported that before the war, President Nasser had spoken with Hamad Shakari, the founder of the recently formed Palestine Liberation Organization. Nasser had proposed that Jews who survived the war be returned to their home countries. Shakari had replied that there was no need to worry about it, as there wouldn't be any Jewish survivors. The war started on a Monday. The following Saturday, the radio announced that it was over. Israel had won such a one-sided victory that it felt to many Jews less like a modern-day war than a miracle from the Bible. The country was suddenly more than twice as big as it had been a few days earlier, and controlled the old city of Jerusalem, along with all the holy places. Just a week before, it had been the size of New Jersey. Now it was bigger than Texas, with far more defensible borders. The radio stopped airing battle reports and played joyous Hebrew songs about Jerusalem. Here was another way Israel was different from the United States. Its wars were short, and someone always won. On Thursday, Barbara got a message from a soldier in Amos's unit. He let her know that Amos was alive. On Friday, Amos drove up to their desert beige apartment building in an army jeep and told her to hop in. Together, they drove around the newly conquered West Bank. Along the way were strange and wonderful sights. Warm reunions in the old city of Jerusalem between Arab and Jewish shopkeepers, separated since 1948. A line of Arab men walking arm in arm up Rupin Boulevard in the Jewish quarter and pausing at the stoplights to clap. For the stoplights. The West Bank they found littered with burned-out Jordanian tanks and jeeps and empty tuna fish cans left by Israelis who had already come to picnic. They ended up in East Jerusalem, at the half-built summer palace of Jordan's King Hussein, where Amos was now stationed, along with a couple of hundred other Israeli soldiers. That villa was really a shock, Barbara wrote to her family in Michigan that night, combining the worst of Arabic taste with the worst of Miami Beach. Later came the funerals. This morning the figures were published in the newspaper. 679 dead, 2,563 wounded, Barbara wrote in a letter home. Though the numbers are small, so is the country, so everyone can count the dead among his friends. Amos had lost one of his men in an attack that he had led on a monastery on top of a hill in Bethlehem. Elsewhere on the battlefield, one of his best friends from childhood had been killed by a sniper, and several Hebrew University professors had been killed or wounded. I grew up in the Vietnam War, and I hadn't known anyone who had gone to Vietnam, much less died there, said Barbara. I knew four people who were killed in the Six-Day War, and I'd only been there 6 months. For a week or so after the war, Amos camped at King Hussein's summer palace. He was then installed briefly as military governor of Jericho. Hebrew University was turned into a prisoner of war camp. But classes at the university started again on June 26th, and the professors who had fought in the war were expected to resume their former posts without a lot of fuss. Among them was Amnon Rappaport, who had returned with Amos to Israel, joined him in Hebrew University's Department of Psychology, and taken his natural place as Amos's closest friend. When Amos set off with his infantry unit, Amnon had climbed into another tank and rolled back into Jordan. His tanks had taken the lead in breaking through the Jordanian army's front lines. This time Amnon had to admit to himself that this business of leaping into and out of wars had left him in a less than tranquil state of mind. I mean, how is it possible? I am a young assistant professor, and they take me, and within 24 hours I start killing people and become a killing machine. I didn't know how to put it together. The dreams troubled me for several months. Amos and I talked about it, how to reconcile these two sides of life, professor and killer. He and Amos had always assumed that they would work jointly to explore how people made decisions, but Amos was attached at the hip to Israel, and Amnon, once again, just wanted to get away. The problem to Amnon wasn't just the constant warfare. The idea of working with Amos had lost its allure. He was so dominating intellectually, said Amnon. I realized that I didn't want to stay in the shadow of Amos all my life. In 1968, Amnon took off for the United States, became a professor at the University of North Carolina, and left Amos without anyone to talk to. In early 1967, Avishai Henick was 21 years old and working on a kibbutz in range of the Golan Heights. Every now and then the Syrians above him fired shells down on the kibbutz, but Avi didn't give it much thought. He just finished his army service, and even though he had been a poor student in high school, was thinking of going to university. In May 1967, he was trying, without a great deal of success, to decide what he would study, and the Israeli army called him back into service. If they were calling him, Avi assumed there was going to be a war. He joined a unit of maybe 150 paratroopers, most of whom he'd never laid eyes on. 10 days later, the war broke out. Avi had never seen combat. At first, his commanding officer said that he was going to parachute into the Sinai and fight Egyptians. Then they changed their minds and ordered Avi's unit to board buses for Jerusalem, where a second front with Jordan had opened. In Jerusalem, there were two points of attack on the Jordanian troops entrenched just outside the old city. Avi's unit slipped through the Jordanian front lines without firing a shot. The Jordanians didn't even notice, he said. Hours later, a second Israeli paratrooper unit followed and was cut to bits. Avi's unit had gotten lucky. Once past the front lines, his unit approached the old walls. That's when the shooting started, he said. Avi found himself trotting right beside a young man he liked named Moshe. Avi had only just met him a few days earlier, but he'd remember his face forever. A bullet struck Moshe and he fell. He was dead in a minute. Avi moved on with the sense that at any moment he might die too. I was terrified, he said, really afraid. His unit fought their way through the old city, and along the way 10 more men were killed. It was one here, one there. Avi recalled images and dramatic moments. Moshe's face, the Jordanian mayor of Jerusalem approaching his unit waving a white flag, standing beside the wailing wall. The last was incredible. I was shocked. I'd seen it in pictures, and now I'm standing right beside it. He turned to his commander and said how happy he was, and his commander replied, "Well, Avishai, you will not be happy tomorrow when you hear how many have been killed." Avi found a phone and called his mother and said simply, "I'm alive." Avi's six-day war wasn't over. Having taken the old city of Jerusalem, the surviving paratroopers in his unit were dispatched to the Golan Heights. Now they would fight Syrians. Along the way, they met a middle-aged woman who came up to them and said, "You are paratroopers? Has anyone seen my Moshe?" None of them had the courage to tell her what had happened to her son. Once they walked into the shadow of the Golan Heights, they were told their assignment. They would ascend in helicopters, jump out, and attack the Syrian troops in their trenches. Hearing this, Avi became oddly but completely certain that he was about to die. "I had the feeling that if I didn't die in Jerusalem, I would die in the Golan Heights," he said. "You don't get two chances." His commanding officer assigned him to walk point in the Syrian trenches. He would run in the front of a line of Israeli paratroopers until he was either killed or out of bullets. Then, the very morning they were to go, the Israeli government announced that there would be a ceasefire at 6:30 p.m. For a brief moment, Avi felt as if his life had been handed back to him. And yet, his commanding officer insisted on proceeding with the attack. Avi couldn't understand it and summoned the nerve to ask his commanding officer why. Why go when the war will be over in a few hours? He said, "Avi, you are so naive. Do you think we will not take the Golan Heights even though there will be a ceasefire?" I said, "Okay, prepare to die." With Avi in the lead, the paratrooper battalion stormed the Golan Heights in helicopters and leapt into the Syrian trenches, and the Syrians were gone. The trenches were empty. After the war, Avi, by then 22 years old, finally decided what he would study, psychology. Had you asked him just then why he picked psychology, I would say I want to understand the human soul. Not the mind, the soul. Hebrew University had no room for him, so he went to a new university south of Tel Aviv called the University of the Negev. The campus was in Beersheba. He took two classes from a professor named Danny Kahneman, who was moonlighting because his job at Hebrew University didn't pay enough. The first was an introduction to statistics, which sounded deadly, only it wasn't. He made it real by taking all these examples from life, recalled Avi. He wasn't just teaching statistics, he was teaching, what is the meaning of all this? Danny was then helping the Israeli Air Force to train fighter pilots. He'd noticed that the instructors believed that, in teaching men to fly jets, criticism was more useful than praise. They'd explained to Danny that he only needed to see what happened after they praised a pilot for having performed especially well, or criticized him for performing especially badly. The pilot who is praised always performed worse the next time out, and the pilot who is criticized always performed better. Danny watched for a bit and then explained to them what was actually going on. The pilot who is praised because he had flown exceptionally well, like the pilot who was chastised after he had flown exceptionally badly, simply were regressing to the mean. They'd have tended to perform better or worse even if the teacher had said nothing at all. An illusion of the mind tricked teachers and probably many others, into thinking that their words were less effective when they gave pleasure than when they gave pain. Statistics wasn't just boring numbers. It contained ideas that allowed you to glimpse deep truths about human life. Because we tend to reward others when they do well and punish them when they do badly, and because there is regression to the mean, Danny later wrote, it is part of the human condition that we are statistically punished for rewarding others and rewarded for punishing them. The other class Danny taught was about perception, how the senses interpreted and occasionally misled. Let me tell you, after two classes it was clear that this guy was brilliant, said Avi. Danny recited long passages from the Talmud in which the rabbis described day turning to night and night turning to day, then asked the class, what colors are these rabbis seeing at that moment when day turns to night? What did psychology have to say about the way the rabbis saw the world around them? Then he told them about the Purkinje effect, named for the Czech physiologist who had first described it in the early 19th century. Purkinje had noticed that colors that appeared brightest to the human eye in broad daylight appeared the darkest at dusk, and so, for instance, what the rabbis saw as vividly red in the morning might appear, in contrast to other colors, almost colorless in the evening. Danny seemed to have in his head not only every strange phenomenon ever uncovered by anyone, but an ability to describe them all in ways that led a student to see the world just a bit differently. And he came to class with nothing, said Avi. He just came in and started talking. A part of Avi couldn't quite believe the spontaneity of Danny's performances. He wondered if perhaps Danny had memorized his lectures and was just showing off. That suspicion was dispelled the day that Danny arrived to class and asked for help. He came to me, recalled Avi, and he said, Avi, my students at Hebrew University want me to give them something in writing, and I don't have anything. I saw you writing notes. Can I have them so I have something to give them? Everything was in his head. Avi soon learned that Danny expected his students to stuff their minds in much the same way that he had. Toward the end of his class on perception, Avi was called to Army Reserve duty. He went to Danny to say that, sadly, he needed to leave to patrol some remote border, and so he didn't see how he could keep up with the work and had to drop out of the class. Danny said to me, it's okay, just learn the books. And I said, what do you mean, just learn the books? And he said, take the books with you and memorize them. And so that's what Avi had done. He returned to Danny's classroom just in time for the final exam. He'd memorized the books. Before Danny handed back the exams to the students, he asked Avi to raise his hand. I raised my hand. What did I do this time? Danny says, you got 100%, and if someone gets a grade like this, it should be said publicly. After studying with this moonlighting professor from Hebrew University, Avi made two decisions. He would himself become a psychologist, and he would study at Hebrew University. He assumed that Hebrew University must be a magical place where the professors were geniuses who inspired their students to new heights of passion for their subjects. And so, for graduate school, Avi went to Hebrew University. At the end of his first year, the head of Hebrew University's Department of Psychology, surveying students, pulled Avi aside. "How are your teachers?" he asked.
"They're okay," said Avi.
"Okay," said the department head. "Just okay? Why are they only okay?"
"I had this one teacher in Beersheba," Avi started to say. The department head immediately sensed what had happened.
"Oh," he said, "you're comparing them to Danny Kahneman. You can't do that. It's not fair to them. There's a category of teacher called Kahnemans. You cannot compare teachers to Kahnemans. You can say this guy is bad or good compared to others, that's okay, but not to Kahneman."
Inside the classroom, Danny was simply a bold genius. Outside the classroom, well, Avi was surprised by the volatility of Danny's state of mind. One day on campus, he ran into Danny and found him in a seriously dark mood, unlike anything Avi had ever seen. A student had just given him a bad review, Danny explained, and he thought that maybe he was all washed up. "He even asked me, 'I'm still the same man, right?'" It was obvious to Avi and to everyone else but Danny that the student was a fool. "Danny was the best teacher at Hebrew University," said Avi, "but it was very hard to convince him that the review didn't matter, that he was excellent." This was just the first of many sources of complication for Danny Kahneman. He was unusually inclined to believe the worst anyone said about him. "He was very insecure," Avi said. "This is part of his character." To those he saw every day, Danny seemed unknowable. The picture people had in their minds of him was ever-shifting, like one of those sketches used for experiments by the Gestalt psychologists. "He was moody in the extreme," said a former faculty colleague. "You never knew which Danny you were going to meet. He was very vulnerable, starving for admiration and affection, very edgy, very impressionable, but could get easily insulted. He smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day. He'd married, and his wife had given birth to a son and a daughter, but Danny still seemed to others to live entirely through his work. He was very much task-oriented," said Zohar Shapira, a student of Danny's who later became a professor at New York University. "You would not say he was a happy person. His moods put distance between Danny and other people, a bit like the distance caused by intense grief. Women felt the urge to care for him," says Yaffa Singer, who worked with Danny in the Israeli Army's psychology unit. "He was always in doubt," said Dalia Etzion, who served as Danny's teaching assistant. "I remember coming to him, and he was blue. He was teaching, and he said, 'I'm sure the students don't like me.' I thought, what does it matter? And it was bizarre because the students love him." Another colleague said, "He was like Woody Allen without the humor." Danny's volatility was a weakness and, less obviously, also a strength. It led him almost inadvertently to broaden himself. It turned out that Danny never really had to decide what kind of psychologist he would be. He could be and would be many different kinds of psychologists. At the same time that he was losing his faith in his ability to study personality, he was building a laboratory in which he might study vision. Danny's lab had this bench where subjects would be immobilized in a device constructed for that purpose with their mouths stuck in an impression of their own teeth, while Danny flashed various signals at their pupils. The only way to understand a mechanism such as the eye, he thought, was by studying the mistakes that it made. Error wasn't merely instructive, it was the key that might unlock the deep nature of the mechanism. "How do you understand memory?" he asked. "You don't study memory, you study forgetting." In his vision lab, Danny searched for the ways people's eyes played tricks on them. When exposed to vanishingly brief flashes of light, for example, the brightness that the eye experienced wasn't some straightforward function of the brightness of the flash. It also depended on the length of the flash. It was in fact a product of the length of the flash and its intensity. A 1-millisecond flash with an intensity of 10x was indistinguishable from a 10-millisecond flash with an intensity of x. But when flashes of light were longer than about 300 milliseconds, the brightness looked the same to people, no matter how long the flash lasted. The point of bothering to discover this was unclear, even to Danny, except that there was demand for such stuff in psychology journals, and he thought that the measuring was itself good training for him. "I was doing science," he said, "and I was being very deliberate about what I was doing. I consciously viewed what I was doing as filling a gap in my education, something I needed to do to become a serious scientist." This sort of science didn't come naturally to him. A vision lab demanded precision, and Danny was about as precise as a desert storm. In the chaos that was his office, his secretary got so tired of being asked to help him search for his scissors that she tied them by a string to his desk chair. Even his interests were chaotic. That the same person could be mentally following school kids into the wilderness to ask them how many people they wanted sleeping in their tent, and sticking grown-ups' teeth into a vise to study how their eyes worked, struck even other psychologists as odd. Personality testers were hunting for loose correlations between some trait and some behavior, tent choice and sociability, for example, or IQ and job performance. They didn't need to be precise, and they need know nothing about people as biological organisms. Danny's studies of the human eye felt less like psychology than ophthalmology. He nursed along other interests, too. He wanted to study what was known to psychologists as perceptual defense, but to everybody else as subliminal perception. A wave of anxiety had swept the United States in the late 1950s, thanks to a book by Vance Packard called The Hidden Persuaders, about the power of advertising to warp people's decisions by influencing them subconsciously. Peak craze came in New Jersey, where a market researcher claimed that he had spliced imperceptibly brief messages like, "Hungry? Eat popcorn," and "Drink Coca-Cola," into a movie and created a surge of demand for popcorn and Coke. He later confessed he'd made it all up. Psychologists in the late 1940s had detected, or claimed to have detected, the mind's ability to defend itself from what it ostensibly did not want to perceive. When the experimenters flashed taboo words in front of subjects' eyes, for instance, the subjects read them as some less troubling word. At the same time, people were also influenced by the world around them in all sorts of ways without being entirely conscious of it. Stuff got into the mind without the mind's full awareness. How did these unconscious processes work? How could a person understand a word well enough to distort it without first having perceived it in some fashion? Was there perhaps more than one mechanism inside the mind at work? Did some part of the mind perceive incoming signals, say, while another part of the mind blocked them? "I was always interested in the question, are there other ways to understand your experience?" Danny said. Perceptual defense was interesting because it seemed to get at unconscious life with proper experimental techniques. Danny designed some tests himself to see if, as he suspected, people were able to learn subconsciously. He showed subjects a series of playing cards or numbers, for example, and then asked them to predict what would come next. There was a hard-to-detect sequence in the cards or the numbers. If the subjects were able to sense the sequence, they would guess the next card or number more frequently than they would by chance, and they wouldn't know why. They'd have perceived the pattern without being aware of it. They'd have learned something subconsciously. Danny abandoned his experiments after he decided that his subjects had learned nothing. That was another thing colleagues and students noticed about Danny, how quickly he moved on from his enthusiasms, how easily he accepted failure. It was as if he expected it. But he wasn't afraid of it. He'd try anything. He thought of himself as someone who enjoyed, more than most, changing his mind. "I get a sense of movement and discovery whenever I find a flaw in my thinking," he said. His theory of himself dovetailed neatly with his moodiness. In his darker moods, he became fatalistic, and so wasn't surprised or disturbed when he did fail. He'd been proved right. In his up moments, he was so full of enthusiasm that he seemed to forget the possibility of failure and would run with any new idea that came his way. "He could drive people up the wall with his volatility," said fellow Hebrew University psychologist Maya Bar-Hillel. Something was genius one day and crap the next, and genius the next day and crap the next. What drove others crazy might have helped to keep Danny sane. His moods were grease for his idea factory. If Danny's various intellectual pursuits had a common theme, other than his interest in them, it was hard for others to detect it. "He had no ability to see what is a waste of time and what is not," said Dalia Etzion. "He was willing to accept anything as possibly interesting." Suspicious of psychoanalysis, "I always thought it was a lot of mumbo-jumbo," he nevertheless accepted an invitation from the American psychoanalyst David Rappaport to spend a summer at the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Each Friday morning, the Austin Riggs psychoanalysts, some of the biggest names in the field, would gather to discuss a patient whom they had spent a month observing. All these experts would have by then written up their reports on the patient. After delivering their diagnoses, they would bring in the patient for an interview. One week, Danny watched the psychoanalyst discuss a patient, a young woman. The night before they were meant to interview her, she committed suicide. None of the psychoanalysts, world experts who had spent a month studying the woman's mental state, had worried that she might kill herself. None of their reports so much as hinted at the risk of suicide. Now they all agreed. How could we have missed it? Danny recalled. The signs were all there. It made so much sense to them after the fact, and so little sense before the fact. Any faint interest Danny might have had in psychoanalysis vanished. I was aware at the time that this was very instructive, he said. Not about the troubled patients, but about the psychoanalysts, or anyone else who was in a position to revise his forecast about the outcome of some uncertain event once he had knowledge of that outcome. In 1965, he went to the University of Michigan for postdoctoral study with a psychologist named Gerald Blum. Blum was busy testing how powerful emotional states changed the way people handled various mental tasks. To do this, he needed to induce in his subjects powerful emotional states. He did so with hypnosis. He'd first ask people to describe in detail some horrible life experience. He'd then give them a trigger to associate with the event, say, a card that read A100. Then he'd hypnotize them, show them the card, and, sure enough, they'd instantly start to relive their horrible experience. Then he'd see how they performed some taxing mental task, say, repeating a string of numbers. It was weird, and I did not take to it, said Danny, though he did learn how to hypnotize people. I ran some sessions with our best subject, a tall, thin guy, whose eyes would bulge and his face redden as he was shown the A100 card that instructed him to have the worst emotional experience of his life for a few seconds. Once again, it wasn't long before Danny found himself undermining the validity of the entire enterprise. One day I asked, "How about we give them a choice between that and a mild electric shock?" he recalled. He figured that anyone given a choice between reliving the worst experience of his life and a mild electric shock would choose the shock. None of the patients wanted the shock. They all said they'd much rather relive the worst experience of their lives. Blum was horrified because he wouldn't hurt a fly, said Danny. And that's when I realized that it was a stupid game, that it cannot be the worst experience of their lives. Somebody is faking. And so I got out of that field. That same year, a psychologist named Eckhart Hess wrote an article in Scientific American that caught Danny's eye. What didn't? Hess described the results of experiments he'd done measuring the dilation and constriction of the pupil in response to all sorts of stimuli. You showed a man the picture of a scantily dressed woman, and his pupils expanded. The same thing happened when you showed a woman a picture of a good-looking man. On the other hand, if you showed people a picture of a shark, their pupils shrank. Abstract art had the same effect, curiously. If you gave people something tasty to drink, their pupils dilated. If you gave them something unpleasant, lemon juice or quinine, their pupils shrank. If you gave them tastes of 5 subtly different orange fizzy drinks, their pupils registered the degree of pleasure they got from each. People reacted incredibly quickly before they were entirely conscious of which one they liked best. The essential sensitivity of the pupil response, wrote Hess, suggests that it can reveal preferences in some cases in which the actual taste differences are so slight that the subject cannot even articulate them. The eye might offer a window into the mind. In Blum's hypnosis lab, with a psychologist named Jackson Beatty, whom he'd poached from Blum, Danny set out to investigate how the pupil responded when people were asked to perform various tasks that required mental effort, remember strings of digits or distinguish sounds of different pitches. They were seeking to understand not whether the eye played tricks on the mind, but if the mind also played tricks on the eye, or, as they put it, how intense mental activity hinders perception. They found that it wasn't just emotional arousal that altered the size of the pupil. Mental effort had the same effect. There was, quite possibly, as they put it, an antagonism between thinking and perceiving. From Michigan, Danny planned to return to a tenured job at Hebrew University. When the university delayed its decision on whether to give him tenure, he refused to return. "I was very angry," he said. "I called and said, 'I'm not coming back.'" Instead, in the fall of 1966, he went to Harvard. 3 years at Berkeley had persuaded him that he was smart enough to play in the big leagues. There he heard a talk given by a young British psychologist named Anne Treisman that sent him in yet another direction. In the early 1960s, Treisman had picked up where the work of fellow Brits Colin Cherry and Donald Broadbent had left off. Cherry, a cognitive scientist, had identified what became known as the cocktail party effect. The cocktail party effect was the ability of people to filter a lot of noise for the sounds they wished to hear, as they did when they listened to someone at a cocktail party. It was in those days a practical problem because of the design of air traffic control towers. In the early control towers, the voices of all the pilots who needed guidance were broadcast through loudspeakers. Air traffic controllers had to filter the voices to identify the relevant airplane. It was just assumed that they could ignore the voices that they needed to ignore in order to focus on the voice that required their attention. Together with another British colleague, Neville Moray, Treisman set out to see just how selectively people listened when they listened selectively. "Nobody had done or was doing any research in the field of selective listening," she wrote in her memoir, "so we had it more or less to ourselves." She and Moray had put people in headphones attached to a 2-channel tape recorder and piped 2 different passages of prose simultaneously into separate ears. Treisman asked the subjects to repeat back to her as they listened one of the passages. Afterward, she asked them what they had picked up from the passage they had supposedly ignored. It turned out that they hadn't entirely ignored it. Some words and phrases got through to the mind, even if they hadn't been invited. For instance, if their name was in the passage that they were assigned to ignore, people would often hear it. This surprised Treisman, along with the few other people then paying attention to attention. "I thought at the time that attention was a complete filtering," said Treisman, "but it turns out that some kind of monitoring goes on. The question I had was, how do we do this? When and how does the content get through?" In her Harvard talk, Treisman proposed that people possessed not an on-off switch that enabled them to pay attention to whatever they intended to pay attention to, but a more subtle mechanism that selectively weakened, rather than entirely blocked, background noise. That background noise might get through was, of course, not the happiest news for passengers and airplanes circling the control tower, but it was interesting. Anne Treisman was on a flying visit to Harvard, where the demand to hear what she had to say was so great that her talk had to be moved to a big public lecture hall off campus. Danny left the talk filled with new enthusiasm. He asked to be deputized to look after Treisman and her traveling party, which included her mother, her husband, and their 2 small children. He gave them a tour of Harvard. "He was very eager to impress," said Treisman, "and so I let myself be impressed." It would be years before Danny and Anne left their marriages and married each other, but it took no time at all for Danny to engage Treisman's ideas. In the fall of 1967, Danny had gotten over his feelings of being slighted and returned to Hebrew University with the promise of tenure and an entirely new research program. It was now possible, with double-channel tape recorders, to measure how well people divided their attention or switched their attention from one thing to another. It stood to reason that some people might be better at it than others, and that the ability might offer an advantage in certain lines of work. With this in mind, Danny went to England at the invitation of the Cambridge Applied Psychology Unit to test professional soccer players. He thought that there might be a difference in the attention-switching abilities of players in the first Premier League and players in the fourth league. He took the train from Cambridge to Arsenal, home to a Premier League soccer team, with his heavy dual-track tape recorder beside him. He put the headphones on the players and tested their ability to switch from the message playing in one ear to the message playing in the other, and found nothing, or at least no obvious difference between them and the players in the lower-ranked league. A talent for playing soccer didn't require any special ability to switch attention. "Then I thought, this could be critical in pilots," he recalled. He knew from working with flight instructors that the cadets training to fly fighter jets sometimes failed because they either couldn't divide their attention between tasks or were slow to pick up on seemingly unimportant but actually critical background signals. He returned to Israel and tested cadets who were training to fly jets for the Air Force. This time he found what he was looking for. The successful fighter pilots were better able to switch attention than the unsuccessful ones, and both were better at it than Israeli bus drivers. Eventually, one of Danny's students discovered that you could predict, from how efficiently they switched channels, which Israeli bus drivers were more likely to have accidents. There was a relentlessness in the way Danny's mind moved from insight to application. Psychologists, especially the ones who became university professors, weren't exactly known for being useful. The demands of being an Israeli had forced Danny to find a talent in himself he might otherwise never have spotted. His high school friend, Ariel Ginsberg, thought that the Israeli army had made Danny more practical. The creation of a new interview system and its effect on an entire army had been intoxicating. The most popular class Danny taught at Hebrew University was a graduate seminar he called Applications of Psychology. Each week he brought in some real-world problem and told the students to use what they knew from psychology to address it. Some of the problems came from Danny's many attempts to make psychology useful to Israel. After terrorists started placing bombs in city trash cans, and one in the Hebrew University cafeteria in March 1969 that wounded 29 students, Danny asked, "What does psychology tell you that might be useful to the government, which is trying to minimize the public's panic?" Before they could arrive at an answer, the government removed the trash cans. Israelis in the 1960s lived with constant change. Immigrants who had come from city life were channeled onto collective farms. The farms themselves underwent fairly constant technological upheaval. Danny designed a course to train the people who trained the farmers. "Reforms always create winners and losers," Danny explained, "and the losers will always fight harder than the winners." How did you get the losers to accept change? The prevailing strategy on the Israeli farms, which wasn't working very well, was to bully or argue with the people who needed to change. The psychologist Kurt Lewin had suggested persuasively that rather than selling people on some change, you were better off identifying the reasons for their resistance and addressing those. "Imagine a plank held in place by a spring on either side of it," Danny told the students. "How do you move it?" "Well, you can increase the force on one side of the plank, or you can reduce the force on the other side. In one case, the overall tension is reduced," he said, "and in the other, it is increased." And that was a sort of proof that there was an advantage in reducing the tension. "It's a key idea," said Danny, "making it easy to change." Danny was also training Air Force flight instructors to train fighter pilots, but only on the ground. The one time they took him up in a plane, he vomited into his oxygen mask. "How did you get fighter pilots to memorize a series of instructions?" "We started making a long list," recalled Zohar Shapira. Danny says no. He tells us about the magical number 7. "The magical number 7 plus or minus 2, some limits on our capacity for processing information," was a paper written by Harvard psychologist George Miller, which showed that people had the ability to hold in their short-term memory 7 items, more or less. Any attempt to get them to hold more was futile. Miller half-jokingly suggested that the 7 deadly sins, the 7 seas, the 7 days of the week, the 7 primary colors, the 7 wonders of the world, and several other famous sevens had their origins in this mental truth. At any rate, the most effective way to teach people longer strings of information was to feed the information into their minds in smaller chunks. To this, Shapiro recalled, Danny added his own twist. He says you only tell them a few things and get them to sing it. Danny loved the idea of the action song. In his statistics classes, he had actually asked his students to sing the formulas. "He forced you to engage with problems," said Baruch Fischoff, a student who became a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. "Even if they were complicated problems without simple solutions, he made you feel you could do something useful with this science." A lot of the problems Danny threw at his students felt like pure whim. He asked them to design a currency so that it was hard to counterfeit. Was it better for bills of different denominations to resemble each other, as they did in the United States, thus leading anyone accepting them to examine them closely? Or should they have a wide variety of colors and shapes so that they were harder to copy? He asked them how they would design a workplace to make it more efficient. And, of course, they must be familiar with the psychological research showing that some wall colors led workers to be more productive than others. Some of Danny's problems were so abstruse and strange that the student's first response was, "We'll need to go to the library and get back to you on that." "When we said that," recalled Zohar Shapira, Danny responded, mildly upset, by saying, "You have completed a 3-year program in psychology. You are by definition professionals. Don't hide behind research. Use your knowledge to come up with a plan." But what were you supposed to say when Danny brought in a copy of a doctor's prescription from the 12th century, sloppily written in a language you didn't know a word of, and asked you to decode it? "Someone once said that education was knowing what to do when you don't know," said one of his students. Danny took that idea and ran with it. One day, Danny brought in a stack of those games in which the object is to guide a small metal ball through a wooden maze. The assignment he gave his students? Teach someone how to teach someone else how to play the game. "It would never occur to anyone that you could teach this," recalled one of the students. The trick was to break it down into the component skills, learning how to hold your hand steady, learning how to tilt slightly to the right, and so on, then teach them separately, and then, once you taught them all, put them together. The guy at the store who sold the games to Danny found the whole idea of it hysterical. But to Danny, useful advice, however obvious, was better than no advice at all. He asked his students to figure out what advice they would give to an Egyptologist who was having difficulty deciphering a hieroglyph. "He tells us that the guy is going slower and slower and getting more and more stuck," recalled Daniela Gordon, a student who became a researcher in the Israeli army. Then Danny asks, "What should he do?" No one could think of anything. And Danny says, "He should take a nap." Danny's students left every class with a sense that there was really no end to the problems in this world. Danny found problems where none seemed to exist. It was as if he structured the world around him so that it might be understood chiefly as a problem. To each new class, the students arrived wondering what problem he might bring for them to solve. Then one day, he brought them Amos Tversky. Chapter 5. The Collision. Danny and Amos had been at the University of Michigan at the same time for 6 months, but their paths seldom crossed. Their minds, never. Danny had been in one building studying people's pupils, and Amos had been in another, devising mathematical approaches to similarity, measurement, and decision-making. "We had not had much to do with each other," said Danny. The dozen or so graduate students in Danny's seminar at Hebrew University were all surprised when, in the spring of 1969, Amos turned up. Danny never had guests. The seminar was his show. Amos was about as far removed from the real-world problems and applications of psychology as a psychologist could be. Plus, the two men didn't seem to mix. "It was the graduate students' perception that Danny and Amos had some sort of rivalry," said one of the students in the seminar. "They were clearly the stars of the department who somehow or other hadn't gotten in sync." Before he left for North Carolina, Amnon Rappaport had felt that he and Amos disturbed Danny in some way that was hard to pin down. "We thought he was afraid of us or something," said Amnon. "Suspicious of us." For his part, Danny said he'd simply been curious about Amos Tversky. "I think I wanted a chance to know him better," he said. Danny invited Amos to come to his seminar to talk about whatever he wanted to talk about. He was a little surprised that Amos didn't talk about his own work, but then Amos's work was so abstract and theoretical that he probably decided it had no place in the seminar. Those who stopped to think about it found it odd that Amos's work betrayed so little interest in the real world when Amos was so intimately and endlessly engaged with that world, and how, conversely, Danny's work was consumed by real-world problems even as he kept other people at a distance. Amos was now what people referred to, a bit confusingly, as a mathematical psychologist. Non-mathematical psychologists, like Danny, quietly viewed much of mathematical psychology as a series of pointless exercises conducted by people who were using their ability to do math as camouflage for how little of psychological interest they had to say. Mathematical psychologists, for their part, tended to view non-mathematical psychologists as simply too stupid to understand the importance of what they were saying. Amos was then at work with a team of mathematically gifted American academics on what would become a three-volume, molasses-dense, axiom-filled textbook called Foundations of Measurement. More than 1,000 pages of arguments and proofs of how to measure stuff. On the one hand, it was a wildly impressive display of pure thought. On the other, the whole enterprise had a tree-fell-in-the-woods quality to it. How important could the sound it made be if no one was able to hear it? Instead of his own work, Amos talked to Danny's students about the cutting-edge research being done in Ward Edwards's lab at the University of Michigan. Edwards and his students were still engaged in what they considered to be an original line of inquiry. The specific study Amos described was about how people in their decision-making responded to new information. As Amos told it, the psychologists had brought people in and presented them with two book bags filled with poker chips. Each bag contained both red poker chips and white poker chips. In one of the bags, 75% of the chips were white and 25% were red. In the other bag, 75% of the chips were red and 25% were white. The subject picked one of the bags at random and, without glancing inside the bag, began to pull chips out of it, one at a time. After extracting each chip, he'd give the psychologist his best guess of the odds that the bag he was holding was filled with mostly red or mostly white chips. The beauty of the experiment was that there was a correct answer to the question. What is the probability that I am holding the bag of mostly red chips? It was provided by a statistical formula called Bayes' theorem, after Thomas Bayes, who, strangely, left the formula for others to discover in his papers after his death in 1761. Bayes' rule allowed you to calculate the true odds after each new chip was pulled from it that the book bag in question was the one with majority white or majority red chips. Before any chips had been withdrawn, those odds were 50-50. The bag in your hands was equally likely to be either majority red or majority white. But how did the odds shift after each new chip was revealed? That depended, in a big way, on the so-called base rate, the percentage of red versus white chips in the bag. These percentages were presumed to be known. If you know that one bag contains 99% red chips and the other 99% white chips, the color of the first chip drawn from the bag tells you a lot more than if you know that each bag contains only 51% red or white. But how much more does it tell you? Plug the base rate into Bayes' formula and you get an answer. In the case of two bags known to be 75%, 25% majority red or white, the odds that you are holding the bag containing mostly red chips rise by 3 times every time you draw a red chip, and are divided by 3 every time you draw a white chip. If the first chip you draw is red, there is a 3-to-1 or 75% chance that the bag you are holding is majority red. If the second chip you draw is also red, the odds rise to 9-to-1 or 90%. If the third chip you draw is white, they fall back to 3-to-1, and so on. The bigger the base rate, the known ratio of red to white chips, the faster the odds shift around. If the first 3 chips you draw are red, from a bag in which 75% of the chips are known to be either red or white, there's a 27-to-1, or slightly greater than 96%, chance you are holding the bag filled with mostly red chips. The innocent subjects who pulled the poker chips out of the book bags weren't expected to know Bayes' rule. The experiment would have been ruined if they had. Their job was to guess the odds so that the psychologist could compare those guesses with the correct answer. From their guesses, the psychologists hoped to get a sense of just how closely whatever was going on in people's minds resembled a statistical calculation when those minds were presented with new information. Were human beings good, intuitive statisticians? When they didn't know the formula, did they still behave as if they did? At the time, the experiments felt radical and exciting. In the minds of the psychologists, the results spoke to all sorts of real-world problems. How do investors respond to earnings reports, or patients to diagnoses, or political strategists to polls, or coaches to a new score? A woman in her 20s who receives from a single test a diagnosis of breast cancer is many times more likely to have been misdiagnosed than is a woman in her 40s who receives the same diagnosis. The base rates are different. Women in their 20s are far less likely to have breast cancer. Does she sense her own odds? If so, how clearly? Life is filled with games of chance. How well do people play them? How accurately do they assess new information? How do people leap from evidence to a judgment about the state of the world? How aware are they of base rates? Do they allow what just happened to alter, accurately, their sense of the odds of what will happen next? The broad answer to that last question coming from the University of Michigan, Amos reported to Danny's class, was that yes, more or less, they do. Amos presented research done in Ward Edwards' lab that showed that when people draw a red chip from the bag, they do indeed judge the bag to be more likely to contain mostly red chips. If the first 3 chips they withdraw from a bag were red, for instance, they put the odds at 3-to-1 that the bag contained a majority of red chips. The true Bayesian odds were 27-to-1. People shifted the odds in the right direction. In other words, they just didn't shift them dramatically enough. Ward Edwards had coined a phrase to describe how human beings responded to new information. They were conservative Bayesians. That is, they behaved more or less as if they knew Bayes' rule. Of course, no one actually thought that Bayes' formula was grinding away in people's heads. What Edwards, along with a lot of other social scientists, believed and seemed to want to believe was that people behaved as if they had Bayes' formula lodged in their minds. That view dovetailed with the story then winning the day in social science. It had been told best by the economist Milton Friedman. In a 1953 paper, Friedman wrote that a person shooting billiards does not calculate the angles on the table and the force imparted on the